I'm Roger Baker, Executive Director of the Stratfor Center for Applied Geopolitics at RAIN, a global center of excellence for geopolitical intelligence and analysis. Learn how you can put geopolitics to work for your organization at rainnetwork.com.
Welcome to the RAIN Insights podcast from RAIN Network. In this podcast episode, David Lawrence, co-founder of RAIN, speaks with Carmen Medina about the prevalence of societal distrust in the United States and the importance of having community forums. Carmen is a retired senior federal executive with 32 years of experience in the intelligence community and is a recognized national and international expert on intelligence analysis, strategic thinking, diversity of thought, and innovation, and entrepreneurs in the public sector. She is the co-author of the new book, Rebels at Work, A Handbook for Leading Change from Within. She is also the co-author of the landmark Deloitte University press paper on diversity's new frontier, diversity of thought, and the future of the workplace.
Carmen, once again, a very great privilege and honor to be able to sit with you and hear some of your thinking, and obviously following on from our recent webinar about information, disinformation, et cetera. And the reason I very much value the opportunity of one-on-one with you is because you touched upon a number of themes and things that you have been thinking about that I think are worthy of not only sharing with our audience of clients and listeners, but really want to sort of delve deeper into sort of what's keeping you up at night and what you think sort of needs to be done to reclaim some common ground. And one of the themes that most interested me was the notion that you felt there was no longer a center for convening a common understanding about information and the truth and what people really need in terms of their daily lives, what institutions need in terms of their planning and the management of their businesses. And if memory serves me, you made a very interesting observation that you felt the Super Bowl was one of the last remaining centers for convening people. But why don't we start there, and I'd love to hear some of your continued thinking.
Hey, thanks, David, and thanks for initiating this conversation. Yeah, you know, I am truly a sports fan, you know, and I remember some memories I have from being 11 or 12 years old, and my mother has really become a Dallas Cowboys fan, and we're watching the famous championship game between Dallas and Green Bay, and you know, it's called the Ice Bowl.
Remember and it well, so, yeah.
Yeah, you remember that. So I have a lot of memories that are very clear associated with sporting events, but I also have other memories of my life. You know, watching Walter Cronkite, and you know, everybody watching the farewell episode of MASH, and you know, all these memories that everybody would talk about at the time around the water cooler. And you know, hybrid work, of course, has for the most part ended the phenomenon of the water cooler. But I think that there are no common conversational threads to pull in any case. I'm 69 years old, and I still have, you know, lots of friends of similar age, and they're always wanting to ask me, did I see X article in the Washington Post or the New York Times? And I go, no, I haven't. I haven't taken a newspaper in a very long time. So now what's left, as also TV is dying, most people probably under 40 don't watch network TV hardly at all. And that used to be an important convening authority. And now if you look at the list of TV shows with the highest ratings in any past year, almost all of them will be sporting events, live sporting events. So, and the greatest of these live sporting events is the Super Bowl. It's concentrated into just 4 hours on a Sunday evening, and you can count on at least half of American adults, I'm sure more, watching that. So that is, I think, the last convening authority in America today is the Super Bowl and Super Bowl commercials. And I'm always looking at how companies pitch themselves during these commercials. There's a lot of, what's the right word? There's a lot of not taking yourself seriously going on right now among corporate America, which I think was interesting. People trying to be lighthearted. And I think there's a lot of messages, certainly from the National Football League now, around social justice. I think that's a fascinating phenomenon as well. The influence that the players' unions in baseball and in football and in basketball to insist upon what appears to be sincere efforts on part of these sports leagues to advance social justice causes. So there's not a significant convening authority. I think people in my generation totally misunderstand how people 40 and under are getting information. To the extent that anything is left, it's like 4 hours on a Sunday evening, the first week in February. That's about it.
So some interesting observations, and because you spent the vast, vast majority of your professional career addressing national security issues and briefing leadership of a variety of agencies, what would you be telling them about the current environment of how people are getting information and sort of how, maybe most importantly, not just the government, but business leaders should be thinking about how to communicate the messages that they care about?
So one thing I really worry about, and if I were in government, I would be telling government leaders this or find a way to communicate this, is that I think that it is going to be extremely difficult to get public consensus around some important action that has to be taken for national security reasons. So imagine the first Gulf War when Iraq invaded Kuwait, not the response after September 11th, but the first one, where the United States mobilized its military to invade Iraq. Yes, we did end up invading Iraq, but we did not topple Saddam Hussein at that time. I doubt seriously that we could develop a consensus among the American public to tackle that would support this kind of effort in the current environment. There's both too little information, as in we can't depend upon everybody knowing the same things. There is no evening newscast that's noteworthy at all. And there's also too much information, so that if you doubt the official reasons that the government gives for doing X, Y, or Z, you will find plenty of fodder to around which you can build whatever theory you want to. And I think the first time we saw this very clearly was during the response to COVID, although frankly, there was a little bit of it even after the attacks on September 11th, with the 9/11 being a false flag operation conspiracies. And we see it now with Ukraine, the difficulty in building a consensus. We see it really around the Israeli-Hamas dispute. And I think where I really worry is about what will happen when, and I don't think it's if, but when China decides that it wants to resolve the Taiwan issue once and for all. So that's what I would be telling government. What I would be telling business leaders is that you have to have a intentional 360-degree sincere strategy about communicating with your customers and the American public in general. You cannot rely on, for sure, press releases, but even on carefully crafted social media campaigns. Those aren't eventually, I think, going to penetrate, particularly the under 40 demographic. Essentially, you have to be willing to take all the risks involved with kind of organic, spontaneous communications. You have to have people out there who represent your company who are real, you know, are flawed, admit to mistakes, sincerely want other people to contribute. Otherwise, we'll look at Boeing right now with all the issues that they're having. You cannot fight disinformation or bad information after the fact. The only way that you can effectively communicate with your customer set and the American people is to communicate like a real person. And that is probably a skill set that a lot of big, cumbersome organizations have lost.
So it's an interesting point that you're making, and let me see if I can try to interpret it a little bit. There's no longer a center in terms of information flow, or let's call it a common ground where people convene to understand a situation. And as a consequence, enterprises, whether they're in the public or private sector, have to think very, very differently about how they communicate and when they communicate. And I'm hearing you say also about building up a certain degree of goodwill or reputational capital in advance of bad situations when you have to explain some greater issue, incident, or truth. Is that a reasonable summary of what you're seeing and what you're thinking about?
Yes, that is a reasonable summary. Okay.
And just simply because you spoke about Boeing, and there are books and books that are written about corporate events. We went through a hellacious financial crisis in 2008, but there were others. But what's interesting to me, one of the case studies in virtually every business school is, and we're going to date ourselves now, Carmen, is Johnson & Johnson and the Tylenol scare, and how Johnson & Johnson quickly acted to recall their product, even though, you know, they thought, suspected product tampering, isolated incident, et cetera. And it is still, I would say, the company still enjoys the reputational dividends from how they handled that. And notwithstanding going through subsequent issues around everything from the opioid crisis, situations that had to do, you know, it's still being litigated, their talcum powder and various other devices that they make, the company reputation seemed to have been forged early on. And I'm not saying it remains unshakable, but it still has a lasting legacy. And is that part of what you're trying to convey here in terms of a trusted, call it a trusted moment in doing things that are very, very proactive that will earn capital down the road?
Oh, absolutely. But let me give you another specific example. So I'm an American Airlines Executive Platinum level flyer. And a few weeks ago, up on my Facebook page popped up the American Airlines Executive Platinum Facebook group. So I thought, oh, well, I'll join that and maybe I'll get some nice hints. And it's like, I don't know, thousands and thousands of these people occasionally praising American Airlines, but more often complaining about this or that issue. Now, I am sure American Airlines monitors what's going on in this group very carefully. But I have yet to see any evidence that they participate. You know, they might be participating in a kind of secret way where they have a few people pretending to be normal Joes and Janes and occasionally saying a comment. That's a mistake, by the way, because when it's found out, and it will be found out, you will look deceptive and devious and bad. So I don't know if they're doing that or not. But I don't know why they don't have people in there who identify themselves as who they are and engage in sincere, honest conversation with their most important set of customers. I don't get it. Why wouldn't you do that? So I think that, you can conduct a public relations campaign and you can take really smart actions like Johnson & Johnson did around Tylenol. But you also have to understand that the conversation about your companies is occurring second by second, minute by minute, on YouTube, on Instagram, on Facebook. And people are forming opinions based on those conversations. And if you don't have a way to participate, not as a dominating force, but in a kind of equal footing way, I think you're missing an opportunity to proactive. I don't want to sound manipulative. You're missing an opportunity to let people know who you really are and what your values really are. So whenever I look at customer reviews on Google or wherever I'm looking for a company, it doesn't bother me if there are bad reviews of a company because I know anybody can have an off day. It bothers me when there are lots of bad reviews and the company never responds. That I find very annoying.
I'm sure you also find very annoying when you can't tell whether these are real reviews or someone's been carpet bombed.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
And so I'm going to keep going back to the important role you had as advisor, thinker, I'll call it futurist, when you were with the government and advising leaders, not only in terms of what was happening, but what was likely to occur down the road. And so what I'm hearing you say is that in the current environment, things are accelerating much faster than they ever have before. And can I use the word, there's been a balkanization of information and a balkanization of where people go for information and what they in turn will latch onto. And, Mark Twain and Einstein and others have been credited with all sorts of quotes. I'm not going to get into whether he said it or not, but there is a popular expression credited to him about the truth circling falsehoods, lies circling the globe before truth even gets out of bed or puts on its shoes or whatever it is. And so basically what you're highlighting here is the current environment and the need for enterprises to be more proactive and to engage with, I'll use the word authenticity and sincerity, and for people to see that you do care and you're doing that. I would also note that if you were briefing, any of the agencies or the president himself, Carmen, you would also probably say this has now become akin to the carnival game of whack-a-mole, where, you knock the mole down one place and, may pop up in another, and you just have to be prepared for that as well. Let me explore with you a topic that we have discussed before, which is the loss of credibility and the loss of trust. I'll call it the other side of the coin here. And recent Gallup polls, as well as other, have talked about the loss of institutional trust in America, if not globally, both in terms of loss of trust in our government agencies, loss of trust in our press, loss of trust with our academic institutions, with corporate America, et cetera. And how do you think that ties in? And is that irreversible? Is that something that is unfortunately now going to be, you know, tied to this balkanization of information and, you know, with it, you know, everything from conspiracy theories and things like that? How do you think about, you know, the what is now being reported as truly like the nadir of trust in our institutions?
Yes. Yeah, so, well, that's an issue you know, would take a lot of unpacking. I was reading a few weeks ago, I don't know if you follow the Substack Noah Pinion?
I do, actually. Yeah,
it's very excellent.
Yeah.
And he had an interview with Sarah Payne, I think her name is, who teaches strategy at the Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island. And it's a fantastic interview. I don't know if you read it, but I'm recommending it to a lot of people.
Yes.
So she quotes Arnold Toynbee in it, who said, the famous historian, who said that civilizations die from suicide, not by murder. And I thought, well, that is an apt phrase. And I do think that institutions are, I think what happened is that institutions, government in particular, did not really adapt, have yet to truly adapt to what the internet and the digital revolution how that has changed the basic trust dynamic in most societies, almost all societies. You know, I was at CIA in the 90s when the internet came, and I was convinced that the internet was going to change everything, everything involving knowledge organizations. But what I didn't fully understand is that how most governing institutions that we have today, both, you know, like business institutions and then government itself, were designed to operate in a world of slow linear information flows controlled by elites. We no longer have slow linear information flows, nor do elites control them. And yet the institutions, for the most part, keep operating, conducting themselves in that way. So that's one point I want to make. The second point I want to make, which is kind of a new thought that's entered my mind, so I'm not sure it's a good thought yet, but it just struck me, particularly after reading the Sarah Payne interview, that institutions have a normal lifespan. So at the end of World War II, whenever some big problem occurs, everyone gets motivated to create institutions to solve what they thought created that problem. And so we had all these institutions, the Bretton Woods, you know, everything was set up after World War II, and it worked really well. And then I think there's probably a 2 or 3 generation lifespan that we can expect any institution to have. So companies such as IBM, institutions like the Roman Catholic Church, They are outliers in what is, I think, usually a pattern of much faster turnover in institutions. And I think that, you know, the kind of democracy that we have today, which was basically, you know, Franklin Roosevelt began the fireside chats, and we, you know, presidents are expected to have press conferences, et cetera, et cetera. All of that developed in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and all of those institutions and ways of doing business are at the end of their lifespan. So my point is, I don't know that there's anything that the existing category of institutions can actually do to fix the trust problem until they reinvent themselves. And that reinvention, I guess history, again, this is me talking a little bit off the top of my head, but I have been thinking about this. I think that history shows that you don't get motivated. Societies aren't motivated to create new institutions and discard the old ones until some big problems start to happen, like world wars. And, people like to use the World War I analogy. All analogies are cheap in some way, you know, but nevertheless, perhaps useful, kind of like economic models. So I don't know what, in reference to World War I, where are we? You know, is it like 1905 when the Russians lost to Japan in that war? Is it 1910? Is it 1913? I don't know, but I think we are approaching a period of time when there will be significant crises. And the optimistic take on that is that that will motivate us to rebuild institutions. And if I can say one more thing here, I think what's the kind of perilous situation for the West is when it comes time to rebuild the institutions, China is an important new player out there. And I don't actually see how we can ignore their inputs into what those institutions should be. That sounds depressing even to me, but you know.
So let me, I won't identify, but a number of years ago, just this was around the issues of cybersecurity and, obviously a number of very prominent leaders in the government have gone on road tours to talk about the threats to infrastructure and companies and the loss of IP and et cetera. We're still trying to figure this out, how to address it. But I said to this individual who was a former head of one of the leading intelligence agencies, can you explain to me why there really has not been a unified response to this issue? I said, if in analog terms, if people came on our shores and were breaking into our companies and stealing secrets, if people were disrupting our telephone lines, if coming on shore and, you know, otherwise surveilling our communications and otherwise defrauding people out of money by knocking on their door. And I went through this whole, you know, basically in an non-digital world. You know, all these are ancient schemes. I mean, they're ancient crimes. And I said, can you explain why we haven't been able to come up with, as we have before, sort of the set of laws, the set of treaties, the so-called 911 that you can call, and, you know, we invented the internet. How come we haven't invented a safe internet yet? You know, the people who patrol the highways, who can monitor these things. And I said, well, is it going to take a crisis? And he looked at me for a second and he said, David, unfortunately, I think it will. That's the way DC these days operates. It's going to take a crisis. And of course, we will over-respond and respond in all the wrong ways and have to figure it out 10 years down the road. And he cited, you know, very much to the response to 9/11, et cetera. And, you know, even the response to the financial crisis, which we still, you know, continue to monitor. I think it was the 1 year anniversary we just had of the run on Silicon Valley and some of the other banks. So you may be onto something, Carmen, that it may take a crisis to reinvent or to have the political will to begin to think about what is needed in this environment. Obviously, we're facing an election. We'll see what shenanigans may occur around the election, and maybe that will provide some impetus here.
Take a look at Haiti right now. I have in the past reflected on how both sturdy the social order in the United States is, or pick whatever Western European country you want to, but also how fragile it is actually. You know, if enough people get motivated by we have nothing to lose, really bad stuff can happen. Haiti has always historically been its own worst case example. You know, it's occupied the far left end of whatever national country spectrum, social spectrum you want to think of. But there are hints of that even in the United States, like January 6th. So I think the idea of a social compact between government and the citizens cannot be taken for granted. And the scaffolding that you have around that social contract has to be rebuilt to take into account significantly different forces in society today. And that is, you know, really, I think one of the tragedies of having two people of a certain age running for president of the United States. It's like, you can't be hopeful that uppermost in their minds will be, what do we need to do to reinvent ourselves?
So, good segue into my next question. And when you say to reinvent ourselves, I would argue to restore trust and to restore the common ground. I'm reminded of another conversation we've had, which is, you know, the issue of what constitutes the truth. And there was a time we've spoken about this where McLuhan cites to the advent of 7 o'clock news on television occurring during the dinner table time for most families. And he and others were pondering, I think William Safire as well, pondering what was going to be the impact of that. And now we have obviously disparate places for information and was very interesting because we're in the middle of this whole debate about TikTok. I think it was interesting listening to some of the politicians who were speaking, and, you know, there seems to be bipartisan concern for TikTok and, you know, other platforms. But almost as though we're waking up to the fact that the younger generation is getting their news almost exclusively, or a vast majority, from TikTok, from short videos, etc. And I'm reminded a little bit of the famous Japanese film Rashomon, which I think was in 1950. This is before my time, but I saw it as part of college film class. But the classic Japanese film by Kurosawa, which tells a tale of a particular event, a heinous crime, witnessed by four individuals, all of whom walk away with different impressions of what they have witnessed, all of which are plausible. And just in terms of your thinking and thinking about where people are getting their information, where they're forming their opinions, where they are making their choices in the marketplace, where they are deciding whom to support in elections, where they are, you know, what I'll refer to as gaining the information to form opinions around a wide range of things. How do you think about sort of restoring a reasonable center where people can go, and what would be needed there, Carmen?
Well, first I'll say, you know, I'm not on TikTok, but I am aware of many people who are on TikTok who also maintain a YouTube presence. And TikTok is not evil. I mean, the information that may come out of TikTok could be used by people with bad intent to, you know, train artificial intelligence or whatever the arguments are. But TikTok is not in and of itself evil. And what's happening on TikTok is not trivial. So, for example, there are biblical scholars who are making a living by presenting their serious scholarship on short videos on TikTok, and they get millions of views. So, you know, I want to dispel the idea that what the people, the younger people for the most part, who are on TikTok are looking for is just shallow entertainment. There's no doubt that many people are looking for shallow entertainment, and I'm happy to look for shallow entertainment as well. But there are equal parts or seemingly significant numbers of people who use it and are looking for serious and good information. And so I noted that President Biden went on TikTok a couple of weeks ago. And I think, this idea that, well, this new network is very popular and we're going to forbid federal employees from being on it, which I think is the current policy, that's basically not right. I mean, when newspapers began to have pictures in them, there were some newspapers who said, well, we're never going to put pictures on our papers because that's cheapening. And when television showed up, now we think of the evening news as some noble thing, but nope, a lot of people, still to this day refuse to have televisions in their home because they think somehow it makes us dumber or cheapens us. So that's the first thing I want to say, is that you just can't keep ignoring or condemning new platforms as trivial or embarrassing. And I know there's a particular issue with TikTok that we just have to cast aside, because there will be something new after TikTok. And the initial reaction of all institutions is to demean them and hope that they're irrelevant. And that's always, if you want to rebuild trust, that's always the wrong response. You have to say, oh, this is where the people are now. And so this is where we're going to have to learn to communicate effectively with our citizens and our constituents and our customers. And there are very few government institutions or businesses that I can think of that have had this kind of or have now this kind of attitude. Oh, this is exciting. A new way of communicating. Let's master it. that's not the response that they have. They tend to have the opposite response, which just doesn't make any sense.
And so let me interpret again. The notion here that we clearly, one cannot be wedded to what's worked in the past. We have to see what's happening. And even if it's something we don't like or something that we might find, you know, I'll call it subject to criticism, we still have to understand it. We have to understand why people are convening around it, and we have to engage.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And really, I think why TikTok was so successful is that it was designed specifically for use on smartphones. Everything about TikTok, including, you know, the angle that the camera videos are captured in, everything about TikTok was designed for use by smartphone. And it was probably, you know, I could be wrong, but it was certainly one of the first to go, oh, smartphones are everything now, so let's design our platform to be smartphone first. That was the, I think, the really smart move that the TikTok people made. Now, let's put this in the context of business or government. Business has done a much better job of going, oh, everything is going to be done through the smartphone, at least for now, so we're going to have great apps that will capture people. And then there's government, which has gone, oh, I don't know what to do about this, and therefore has lost the ability to communicate effectively with its citizens. I think the key thing about TikTok was that they recognized that the smartphone it used to be that the newspaper was what democracy was built around, and now really it's the smartphone. I know that sounds really weird, and the fact that it sounds weird is part of the problem.
Well, I'll also say they very smartly understood attention spans and, you know, what could capture what, you know, what I'll refer to as people's interests and virality.
Yeah, that's a very good, yeah. A very good point, David. Yeah. Short and easy and to see on your smartphone. You don't have to go anywhere else. That's the secret sauce of TikTok.
And one of, obviously, the ability to share with people, mm-hmm. right? Because people, they like to share. They like to enjoy things in groups. I mean, you watch people. They used to want to go into movie theaters to watch films together with other people. There was an interesting observation, and I don't want to get into the divestment of TikTok or any of that stuff, but that had to do with the algorithm and obviously the ownership of the algorithm. But an observation has been made that it is rather remarkable that the Chinese were able to capture the interests, the interests plural, and the curiosity and the engagement secret sauce of the American youth far better than American companies or the government itself. That is an interesting observation.
Yes, and, it is.
Right? Yeah. And, you know, capturing the American public. It's not the first time that something imported to the States, you know, was designed or developed elsewhere. But there is a lesson about what we need to do and how we need to think about things.
Yeah, absolutely. And, of course, it's ironic that the Chinese people themselves, I think I'm right, can't be on at least the...
No, right. They're on TikTok, but they're limited in terms of time.
Yeah,
and they
exactly.
get science and math videos.
Yes,
not, you know, some of the other stuff. Okay,
yeah, so... But I have to say, one of the things the Chinese government, I think, got understood better than the U.S. government was that everything was going to be digital in the future. And so they started changing how the government-citizen relationship works. And unfortunately, it is limiting of personal freedom. And unfortunately, the Chinese people, at least for now, appear tolerant of that, or willing to accept it. But, you know, they figured that out in a way that I don't think Western governments figured out, except perhaps for the Baltic states.
Another good point, and I won't get into, they have a different social contract mm-hmm. with their people than we do, and what's permissible and their social scoring. In the few minutes we have remaining, we've spoken about the importance, and it ties into trust, it ties into the method of communication, but the importance of the messenger mattering, if I can use that term, why the messenger matters around information. You recited, you know, the days of Cronkite and Huntley Brinkley, and these were people who were on camera and what was, you know, the yesterday's version of the internet on television. But they were individuals who appeared nightly, whom the American people trusted. And so as you think about what's happening with information, Carmen, and how do you think about what I'll refer to as the importance of messengers that people can trust?
I think that messengers are different now. For example, one of the big platforms on YouTube is something called Jubilee, which has, I don't know, 8 or 9 million viewers, and is a Gen Z favored platform. And they host all these conversations on sometimes quite important topics, like, you know, which is better, communism or capitalism? That's actually a topic of one of their recent YouTube videos. And their format is they don't actually have an identifiable host, but rather they invite what appear to be representative normal people to come on and debate the issue. So I think that one of the things has happened because of the internet revolution is that the importance of authority, you know, perceived authority or claimed authority for a messenger has declined. I mean, look at what happened to Tony Fauci during the COVID epidemic. Or any number of other people who were representing the government position. It used to be that you looked for someone with authority and gravitas to be a messenger. And now, you know, I'm not clear as to exactly who makes a good messenger anymore. But the only thing I'm clear about is that that it's different from the kind of authority, expertise, qualifications for messengers. Celebrities are clearly really important messengers now. I don't know what to make of that because I don't think celebrities really should be messengers for government. So I think the whole messenger thing is very confusing, frankly. I think that the key element is that the whatever that messaging entity is needs to be authentic and genuine and perceived that way by the public.
So, Carmen, I want to thank you, but in advance, maybe I'll leave us with something we can pursue in our next conversation. What at least I am observing is the rise of the people don't refer to them as messengers, but as influencers. And indeed, you actually have some academic institutions that are giving degrees in social media influencing. I'm probably mislabeling this, but there seems to have been a seismic shift in who carries the message, who gets believed, who gets followed, and the impact that they have. One of the interesting aspects, this occupied the media a few weeks ago, but it's going to come back, but is Taylor Swift going to endorse President Biden in the coming election? And I think just from an institutional standpoint, whether it's government or corporate America, thinking about who today has the best ability to carry messages. Obviously, certain CEOs speak, and you still have prominent people. Charlie Munger, who passed away the last few months, and Warren Buffett, if you think about in the financial markets, and certain elected officials carry a great deal of weight and influence and things like that. But there does seem to be emerging as a result of the digital world and the internet, a whole new class of individuals who seem to be able to carry messages and to be believed and to be followed, and who are able to affect public opinion, no less decisions around various elections, et cetera. And so just something that I'm sure you will be watching, we're watching it. And I would just note that that seems to be another piece in the puzzle.
Absolutely. And then, of course, we haven't touched upon this. And if we start touching upon it now, we'll never get off the call. But artificial intelligence will be able to kind of create messengers, I think, or manipulate real-life messengers into saying things that are perhaps not what they would normally say. And so that is also going to be quite confusing as well. I mean, the next 10, 20 years, I think, are going to be just mind-blowing in terms of social and governmental change. You heard it here first.
Well, and indeed, we discussed that on our webinar the other week. Yeah, of what constitutes reality in terms of what you're seeing and hearing and believing. So, Carmen, as always, thank you not only for the time today, but your continued thinking and your continued public service. And I know you continue to and hopefully will continue to have a great deal of influence in how people think about some of the most pressing issues. So thanks again.
Appreciate it so much, David. And you're always, always a knowledgeable and fun person to have a conversation with.
Well, Carmen, I look forward to more. And since we were speaking about a little bit of music recommendations before we went on this podcast, I'm reminded of John Lennon's solo song, Just Give Me Some Truth.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So anyway, with that, thanks again, Carmen, to be continued.
All right. Take care.
This is the RAIN Insights podcast, which is part of the RAIN Insights series, comprised of both virtual and real-world events, offering unique practical perspectives from RAIN's leading experts in risk management. To learn more, please visit us at rainnetwork.com. That's RANE network.com. Thank you for listening.